Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor Jivenkatraman. Professor Jivenkatraman, sir, is already here in our studios. And last week, if you remember, we presented a question and answer session. And today also we'll be continuing with yet another session of question and answer based on Professor's earlier talks in this new series. And as always, the questions will be posed by a panel. And today the panelists are Professor Peter Prusen from Denmark, Radio Sai's Bishop Rushdie, and Sri Aman Javeri, a research scholar from the Department of Management Studies at the Institute. And as always, Professor Venkatraman will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by the panelists. So, over to Professor Venkatraman for his opening remarks and then taking it further. Over to you, sir.
Sai Ram Sunil, and thank you very much. So, he's going to be the first one to throw a brick at me.
Well, I would like to ask Professor Prusen.
Wonderful. I think I'd like to start with a question that Das raises. He says, can Dharma be taught? And he illustrates it with the following. He refers to a study of primary school teachers in India. He says that 1 in 4 teachers in government primary schools is absent, and 1 in 4, although present, does not teach. He then goes on to say, a teacher who is chronically absent wounds Dharma and demeans the teaching profession. Then he asked the question, how does one get a teacher not only to be present, but also to teach with a sense of calling? He says, can Dharma be taught? He then provides an answer. A person's character is not something that one is born with. It is constantly evolving through repeated actions, and one can be educated to become more moral. To become virtuous requires repeating virtuous actions. And I'd like to ask you the following question, sir. Although what he says appears to be very logical, isn't to some extent it a matter of unlearning our bad habits and our tendencies so that we can be in contact with our inherent divinity?
That's a really good question and a thought-provoking one, too. I'd say, Das gives part of the answer. You have supplied the other part. The two must be mixed and put in the right sequence. Dharma is already built into it as a part of the jnana package, because we have the spark of the divine in us, and if the spark of the divine is within us, the wisdom of the divine is also within us, which wisdom of the divine translate into action manifests as dharma. That is the essence of dharma, divinity in action. Now, you talked about unlearning. I will refer to that next. When we are born, we pick up a lot of habits and attitudes, which is related to the process by which we have evolved from lower species into human beings. That evolution brings with it certain baggage. Those are traits that sort of hang on to the senses. It is natural that baggage is there. It's like if you go out and play, you become dirty. Then you need a shower. I mean, imagine a Wimbledon finals that lasts 4 hours. Those fellows not only lost energy, but they are sweat all over and all that. What they would like after getting the prize is to rush to the shower and take a long, hot shower. Now, we don't have that yearning because these tendencies acquired on account of our gunas look so attractive, we hang on to them. So, the natural instinct for dharma is built into us, but it is obscured by this ignorance. And that can be done only by cleansing the ignorance. So what you said is right. What he says is also right when put in the context. So, the teacher, where does the teacher come? The teacher has to be trained. The teachers go through a teacher's training college. Now, if the teacher is not imbibed with a sense of duty, is unlikely to take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And that duty will not come to the teacher unless his teacher himself is duty conscious and becomes an exemplar. If the teacher comes late to the class, mm-hmm. he's not setting an example. If the teacher doesn't prepare for his class, he's not setting an example. If the teacher does not focus on the subject but talks about all sorts of useless things just to kill time because he has not got ready, he's not setting an example. So the whole educational system, starting with teacher training, becomes very important. And I am mentioning all this because I am going to make a small plug. It has been decided to establish here a center that will address itself to training teachers in value-based, imparting value-based education, or rather handling value-based education, not imparting. So the long and short of it is, Dharma is within, but it has to be squeezed out. But before that, you have to open the lid of the toothpaste. That is getting rid of Ajnana. And then the teacher squeezes, automatically things comes out. And you have to be very careful, because you squeeze badly, half the toothpaste will come out. And that's not what you want. So discipline is needed.
That's a wonderful answer. And I just noted down some words that you spoke. And yesterday, the two of us were having a chat about the book and about Das and about that he jumps around, perhaps because he's so secularly oriented, on the one hand, on the other hand. And he doesn't really tell us at any point what he means by Dharma. And you just gave a definition, which for me is three words. You said Dharma...
Did I do that?
Yes, you did. You said
You're a good policeman.
Dharma is divinity in action. And of course here we're making the huge jump which Das is not able to make. We're able to refer to divinity.
Bhagavan in the Dharma Vahini very clearly states that we know it is very difficult to put a framework and say this is a dharmic act and this is not a dharmic act, because you know situations, time, everything changes and everything has to be evaluated looking into all the parameters. But what Swami says at one point is absolute selfless act filled with love, that is a dharmic act.
Yeah, but then the question is, what is selfless, what is love? There are a lot of fine
things. Yeah.
You can always find corners to escape, yes. And which people do. It's like tax. Tax rules are very big. Can I find a corner where I can be, I need not pay tax and still be legal? Say, I followed the rules. Mm-hmm. All the fellows who don't pay taxes say, I followed the rules. That's what you're asking for. Mm-hmm. That's what people who want today's tailored dharma ask for.
Mm-hmm. But this really highlights what is, I think, the greatest challenge in this extremely interesting and inspiring book, is that his starting point is so totally intellectual that he is not able to provide at any point a definition as short, as sweet, and to the point as you just done.
No, don't flatter me.
because the concept of divinity, the concept of the God within us, doesn't exist in his framework.
That is true. That's what I've been trying to say. You're trying to play soccer or football, as I prefer to call it, without a football. That is purely... I mean, I would say that's pretty difficult. It is like that. Where is the basis?
Yes.
So he goes to various people in the chapter. He quickly brushes aside Thomas Aquinas because he's inconvenient truth.
Yes.
Then he sort of walks around David Hume and Kant and Locke, John Locke, and so on and so forth. Very nice, very intellectual. I've been studying, and it gives me a good insight into how Western philosophy has evolved. But somewhere along the line, everyone seems to have abandoned Christ, and if they had stuck to Christ, they would have got half the things right, at least, minimum. Because Christ, through his life, established that is love in action.
But the reason that Kant and Locke and Hume and the others don't hold on to Christ is because they've been revolting against the power of the church and against the power of the royalty, the kings. So they're writing.
I have a feeling they were all trapped by the power of their mind.
Yes.
You see, they were intellectual, and the mind takes possession of them, and the mind deceives them.
Yes.
So they did not have the spark of wisdom to see the mind can play games. That is what my feeling is. Anyway, they are gone, but they set the stage, and I respect them for their intellectual curiosity. Nevertheless, we seem to know what Dharma is. And what we have to say, Mister, you missed the first football, here it is, now play, and there are some rules. Aman, you are waiting.
Sir, you mentioned a very important word, which is very, I am very interested
about. I seem to be doing very well today.
The word is yearning.
Yes.
Sir, whenever we speak to elders who have been close to Bhagavan, yes, we ask them, sir, please tell us how to be close to Swami. And they tell us, see son, you should have intense yearning. And our immediate question is, why don't we have so much intense yearning? And that is my question to you, sir. It everything comes to have yearning. But then how does one develop that yearning, sir? If you don't have it inherently, is there a way
to develop? I don't buy that. You have a yearning for something or the other. Everybody has a yearning. Don't show.
For God, sir. Yearning for God.
That is because God is low in your priority. That is the incorrect truth. Really speaking, you want to be near to Swami. What does that mean? I want to push his chair. I want to give him the kerchief. I want to bring him the water. You don't ask, supposing I'm close to God, what do I do? That question is never asked. They want proximity. Yearning is for proximity. When old students write to say, we are coming for birthday, give us some duties. Say, all right, go and serve food in the Sevadal canteen. No, we want to do Yajur Mandir duty. We want to do rope boys duty. We want to do guard duty. Why? Because Swami is likely to see us and talk to us.
Yes.
So they want something out of that. The yearning is for payback.
Yes, sir.
So that is not what you want. The real yearning must be for the things that Krishna says. If you do this, if a devotee does this, such a devotee is very dear to me. Yomat bhakta samay priha. In 5 or 6 slokas he says that, yes, in the 12th chapter that defines bhakti yoga. He says it in slightly different words, but it defines 5-point or 6-point agenda. Nobody is even aware of it. That's the main point. That way, I was sort of impressed that cricketer Lakshman has been chanting the 12th chapter from his young age.
Yes,
he is probably the only cricketer in the world who knows the 12th chapter. I admire him for that. And he was serious about it in his own way. So there was a yearning. Yes. And he felt apparently that coming here and talking on Radio Sai was a realization of part of the yearning. So, yearning goes with yearning for what and in what manner. We leave things half and then use that missing portion to twist our yearning to suit our yearnings.
I was reminded of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa. You know, when people go and tell him that, you know, why is it that God doesn't speak to us? Why is it that God doesn't communicate with us? He said, you cry for a job, you cry for a family, you cry for this and that. But how many people really cry for God?
Swami has put the same thing in a slightly different way, but very close to that. You cry for your wife, you cry for your money, you cry for this, you cry for that. Have you ever shed a tear for Dharma? His exact words. Have you ever shed a tear for Dharma? Dharma means, Dharma is quite safe. The way the practice of Dharma has declined, have you ever shed a tear? We don't. If we had that conscience, we would not be spending money like hell on trivia at a time when 1 billion people are going hungry every night. And many of them children. We don't even look at that. Yesterday there was a photo in the Hindu. It was some day or the other. He shows a lot of women carrying construction tools in a basket and carrying a baby in the hand. They are going to earn a living. Did that photo touch the heart of anybody? When I saw it, it reminded me of a picture which I saw many years ago on Children's Day or something. A girl, 11 years old or so, she is doing the same thing, carrying bricks and all that. And boys are coming out of a school in their natty school uniform, white shirt, white trousers and ties. They are getting education. She is being denied education in the life, future, and given a niggardly amount for her labor. So we are very comfortable with it. We are not losing sleep over it. That's what Swami means. Have you shed a tear for Dharma? Is it Dharma to cease that such things happen? How many people think about it? Yes, we don't yearn to see that white toad.
This leads to an interesting question that Das touches with. We tend to measure the goodness of our societies by their production, their wealth generation. And we get trapped. According to Das, he says the attraction of a clear, clean ethical theory like utilitarianism. I usually write utilitarianism, but makes
yeah, that's a better word.
Yes. Is that it attempts to resolve moral issues on the basis of a single criterion. Pluralism is more complex, but no less rational. And I think that this is a huge challenge to the teaching and understanding of economics, and that has led to what I would call the gradual erosion of moral behavior and of our environment. Aside from some purely technical and mathematical gymnastics, economics almost exclusively focuses on consequences and motivates the rest of us to focus on artha, ignoring dharma or moksha. What does Swami tell us about this?
You see, Swami doesn't talk about economics, etc. per se. It is up to us to seek those pearls of wisdom by going through his treasure house. But there are two things that Swami says. First and foremost, the motivation for your action is very important. You better get that right. That is like saying, when a pilot is flying from, say, Singapore to London non-stop, it's possible. He is going to follow a flight path, which has been declared in advance. In these days, computers fly planes, so you must make the right settings. But even if he makes the right settings, due to wind and turbulence, there will have to be mid-course corrections. In the olden days, that had to be done manually, so the pilot had to make sure it doesn't stray off. So first you must know where you are going. The bearings must be there. Secondly, you have to maneuver to stay that you get to a destination. And destination in this case is what is going to be the outcome of the action. Mm. Before you talk about the outcome of the action, you must say, am I starting on the right foot? I have got all my basics right. If the plane is turned the wrong way, it may go to the Pacific instead of to London. So, both motivation and the consequences are important. One is the horse, other is the wagon. You don't put the horse before the wagon. So what comes later must be thought about later, but what's the start? That is the most important point. Mm-hmm. And both are important. But if your motivation is not anchored in the right place, then you're going to get it wrong. If your motivation is anchored in the domain where the action is taking place, which is the phenomenal world, there is no connection with divinity. So you have to rise above this. In other words, it's like battery, instrument, a motor. Do you plug it in 110 volts, which is common in the standard in America? Do you plug it in 100 volts, which is the standard in Japan? Or do you plug it in 220 volts, which is the standard in India and many other parts of the world? Swami says, don't plug in any of these things. Plug it in the divine voltage plug point. Then you're getting the motivation right.
Yes.
Now you take hold of the steering wheel and go where you have to go. Everything will be all right from a dharmic point of view. The consequences are part of the divine game. Don't worry about it. Don't try to evaluate.
Sir, but do motivations also change? For example, sir, we know the famous story of Bill Gates. He started out as a very capitalist person, somebody who's interested in his own profits. But as probably he grew up, his motivations have changed. And today he is running one of the world's largest philanthropic institutions. So is it possible, sir, in a similar way that people may start out with not such good motivations, but then over the period of time or over the journey, their motivations do change?
As far as motivations are changing, they happen all the time. You just have to follow politics. They keep hopping from one thing to another. Basically, that hopping is a superficial manifestation of one motivation, which is common. Something good must happen to me, I must make a lot of money. That doesn't change. So, as far as the other aspect you are saying, it is only a question of transformation of the gunas.
Yes.
If Bill Gates has evolved, it means he is evolving from what you call the higher level of rajas, which is very dynamic, being very active and productive,
yes,
to the lower strata of the sattvic. It is going in the right direction.
Yes.
It used to be common in the old days. If you look at Andrew Carnegie, who lived more than 100 years ago, I believe he belonged to Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken. He was a tycoon. He had established steel mills, made a lot of money. He was absolutely ruthless capitalist, if I know correctly. But there came a stage when he said, this country is great. All my children can earn their money. I'm not going to give them a penny. I'm going to give it away to public causes. He set up the Carnegie Mellon University. I mean, he kick-started that university. It's one of the better-known universities, very advanced in computer technology and all that. Then he gave it a lot of philanthropies. He supported art. There is a Carnegie Hall in New York, I believe.
Yes.
And he gave away a lot. He said he came to India also. He saw the Parsis. He was apparently very surprised that they were so charitable. He was very impressed with that. So he said, I ain't giving my money to my children. They can earn it. So people do evolve. It happens all the time. In fact, one day, Swami talked about Rockefeller, the original, yes, John D. Rockefeller, and how he established the University of Chicago. I didn't know it. I had been to the Rockefeller Chapel in Chicago because my brother was a graduate student. I was in America. Every holiday I would go to Chicago with my wife, and then he would show us around. And once I had to travel west by train, I went through Chicago. But till Swami said, I didn't know that university was actually set up by Rockefeller. What he was saying was, if you have money, invest it in education. So motivations ought to change.
Yes.
You have to go up the gunas ladder. And Krishna said, by the way, don't stop there. Jump off the ladder and I will catch you. Go above the gunas. Become a guna atita, yes, one who goes beyond gunas. And that is why Vedanta comes. Go beyond the Vedas. Vedanta.
Yes.
He is sitting on top of that. Come, jump, I'll catch you. But that people don't want to take the risk.
I think definitely today we see a lot of people more inclined towards being sensitive towards society. I mean, you have both the sides, because other day I was reading a news article where fundsindia.com, which is an investment management website, they deal with shares and mutual funds. So among all their high net worth individuals, wealth who that they manage, the article said that almost all of them, they have about 200 high net worth individuals in Chennai, all of them have earmarked 10% of their wealth for philanthropy. And they're asking the wealth management firm to manage that wealth also. That 10%, which they have plans how they want to, you know, spend,
yes,
towards societal development. So that way I think you have these days a lot of people thinking how, you know, moving on from this rajasic to slightly sattvic level.
No, that is always true. The point is, as Gandhi says in his famous speech, in the midst of darkness, life persists. In the midst of evil, goodness persists. Something, I don't remember. So
even Ajay Premji, our chairman of
WIPRO. Yeah, yeah. So the world has survived because there have always been good people. In Tamil, we are saying, if there is rain, it's because of the good people.
Yes.
And
yes,
even if one good man speaks, there will,
yes,
be rain. This way it is.
Yes.
So we forget,
yes,
that good people have existed all along. And that is why the world has survived.
Absolutely.
And today, because there is so much of evil, a few people, notable people who do good get visibility, which is well and good because they encourage others. But we don't realize the thousands of very ordinary people who do good work.
Absolutely.
You know, every morning I see a lot of women coming and sweeping this place. And I, when I was in R4, I remember speaking about it in the foyer that one morning in the college. I saw her come. She went and took her broom. She worshipped the broom. Then she worshipped, that is, you know, Karma Yoga's starting point.
Yes.
She worshipped the broom.
Yes.
And then she, that big building at rest, there was a picture of Swami worship. She started cleaning, no boss, nothing. She was working just like that. Thousands of people do those things.
Yes, yes, sir.
And we don't realize. People drive all night the engines of the trains. Yes. You sleep nicely in the sleeper compartment and go. The people are working. But in the Kali Yuga, in which we are supposed to be now, the evil component is increasing. And that's why Swami says, everybody is a mixture of good and bad. There are no clear-cut good guys, no clear-cut bad guys, and people in between. Everybody is a mixture of good and bad, and the proportion keeps on varying with individuals according to circumstances. In this case, in such a case, there is no question of annihilating the bad guys and saving the good guys. That formula is no longer valid. What has to be done is, I have to personally cleanse each guy, give him a spiritual bath, and remove the evil in that person. I have to squeeze it out. So I can't do it all. I never don't do those jobs. Those jobs are meant for you. I taught it to you in the Dwapara Yuga. Man, you do the cleaning job. You pick up the bucket. I will teach you how. So first I will transform. Then you become a transformer. So he was here. He tried to transform. I hope you have transformed. Now we have to become a transformer in the sense, not like the electrical transformer, go to the other guy and try to help him out. Then he will help out. So you can have a chain reaction.
Absolutely.
Chain reaction is not a made-up thing.
Yes.
Uranium exists to prove that chain reaction is possible.
Yes.
So you can't rubbish it. It's there. All you can say is, I think I'm very busy. Why don't you take care of this job? I've got to go and attend a meeting. So everybody goes and attends meetings. And now you can do it with Skype. So, the era of meetings has come. One good thing is, when everybody is in a meeting, there won't be progress.
But I think, as you're mentioning this, two thoughts come to me. When you mentioned that Swami says, now we should become transformers. The other day I had gone to the hospital.
No, after you are transformed.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a very beautiful quotation in front of the dietary department, and there was a picture of Swami
in the hospital,
in the super speciality hospital. Swami is saying in that photo, till now everyone knew you because of me, but from now on everyone should know me because of you.
That's a good one.
Yes, there is
I hope it's not patented, otherwise we'll have a problem. If it is patented, I'll say, you know, I can't use it because it's copyrighted.
But talking about the hospital, the other thought that came to me is this. When you mentioned about the sweeper, when I was talking to one brother, Bhishma, who's been there in the hospital right from the inception, he was one day telling me that, you know, this hospital is what it is because there are a few people who have been working so silently and so diligently for years. And he gave me examples of one assistant in the operation theater. He gave me one example of a gardener who has been working. These are all people who have been there right from the time the hospital started. They have been there when Bhagwan has visited the hospital so many times. In fact, the other day when my father had to go to the hospital, and he was in the hospital for some time, I saw this lady who come and sweep the place every morning, and you know, she's been there right from the time the hospital. And the fantastic thing is, my father was so touched. He said, see, even if I give like two times or three times the money, no one will serve me with this much love. No one will serve me.
You know, there's a very interesting example that Das himself gives in his book of a teacher in Tamil Nadu in Dharmapuri, who cycles to work and back. It almost comes to 38 miles, isn't it? Or kilometers?
I think it was miles.
Yeah. And he's a very good teacher.
Yes.
An outstanding teacher. Yes. See, we don't realize this is what Karma Yoga is.
Yes.
And that was taught to us 5,000 years ago. And a lot of people unknowingly follow Karma Yoga. He asked that Dharma can be taught. When Dharma becomes a habit in society, you imbibe it. That was the habit of society. Today, we have only the trappings of that. We live a fast life. We hurry around. But the spirit of Karma Yoga is gone.
He appears to take a, Das to take a different opinion on that. He talks about what he calls evolutionary biology.
Yeah, I know.
And he argues that societies have developed moral principles so that people will cooperate. And he says that moral rules are grounded in human self-interest, but they are tempered by our need to live with others. And he talks, he uses the term reciprocal altruism. And he appears to argue that we are developing through this evolutionary biology to a more sensitive society, that we are becoming altruistic in what he calls reciprocal manner. And this appears to conflict with many of the observations that you were just making, where we talk about, in fact, that the world is becoming so hooked on doing things, not on being, and getting back to my earlier point on economic, on vulgar materialism, vulgar capitalism, instead of on justice and on Dharma.
You see, nature always evolves from simplicity to complexity. Initially, there are the fundamental particles, then you got the atoms, then you got molecules, then you got complex substances, very complex substances, proteins, this, that. And that's an evolution. Then these proteins, this, that came together to form living organisms. From this unicellular organism, we have complex entities. Martin Rees was asked, physics is so difficult, stars and all this, physics is so difficult, it's a marvelous thing you have unraveled. He said, stars are very simple systems. What was difficult was the mathematics and the essential physical concepts, but we have to master them with a lot of imagination. They are really not complex systems. So what's a complex system? He stunned the audience by saying a frog. A frog is a complex system. Science will never be able to explain a frog. They all got stunned. And I take it one step further. Francis Collins, who is now heading the human neuron mapping project, he says the human brain is the most complex entity in the whole universe. That's an awesome thing to say. There are 7.2 billion brains walking around. And every one of these is the most complex entity in the whole universe. And the body, which accommodates the brain, makes the humans even more complex than the brain, because we are not the brain. We have the liver, which Dr. Safaya is to admire as next only to the brain. So we are all walking examples of extraordinary complexity and extraordinarily crafted, beautifully crafted systems. Systems evolve to that. Then your operating system must also evolve. Simple computers needed simple operating system. Complex computers need complex operating system. Now, this man's way of looking at things, Mr. Das, is going to leave us with a complex system with an utterly useless operating system. They are not looking at the operating system of this complex system. Mm. And it is going to be built in, have a lot of contradiction. Why? Because you are keeping the individual and society as two separate entities that come together occasionally for certain purposes. Swami said, no, the individual is the building block, society is the macro. If your building blocks are bad, the micro will be bad. You are trying to fix problems in macro independently of looking at the individuals. They are very tightly coupled system. So he gives the example of a healthy human body, copy the operating system of the healthy human body into a system. That's a one-to-one mapping between the human body and the human society. Now, this is a beautiful piece of pearl of wisdom. It is really not known even here. And Swami stopped talking about it. He used to say the proper study of mankind is man. If you look at it very analytically, very closely, you can give a prescription for solving all the problems. But, like the climate change problem, which Al Gore very clearly identified and described as the inconvenient truth, the intelligent person of today will say, this truth is too costly and inconvenient, I'll put it in the garbage, I'll pretend there is no such truth, I will live in my, what you call, illusory era, everything is fine, and go on. So, that is what is going on in the world. There is a problem of dealing with these complex systems. There is a problem and nature has shown the way. It is not that there are no solutions available, but it's too expensive for us. Is it in billions of dollars? No, actually the dollars you will require is much less. I have to give up my, what you call, selfishness and self-interest. That nobody wants to give up. That price is too much to pay. That is really the crux of the problem. At what price? Cost-benefit analysis is done in such a way to make it appear impossible. It's not that the economics is all kept within the realm of the mind. The moment it is taken to the realm of the heart, the whole thing will get inverted. The cost will crash like oil price, but they are trying to come back, sadly. So I don't think the problems are insoluble. And we have kept all these things hidden. And here I am sitting before the mic trying to make the whole world understand there was Swami, he gave all the answers long ago. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. But they don't like that. They like to be a big wheel.
Sir, I have read something and then I was very uncomfortable with that. And I want you to shed some light on that, if we have time.
Yeah, I think that yours will be the last question. Go on.
Yeah. So I just want to quote...
He's shutting us off. Very good.
What you have quoted from Das, sir.
You are using my words against me.
No, sir. What Das has written, you have quoted him.
Yeah.
He says, Dharma is supposed to uphold a certain cosmic balance and is expected to help us balance the plural ends of life. Desire, material well-being and righteousness when they come into conflict. Dharma sets limits on the pursuit of pleasure and wealth. In practice, this implies that maximizes one's own pleasure as long as it does not diminish another's. What we have learned so far, however, is that Dharma does not do a very good job of it. Sir, when I read this, I was a little bit uncomfortable. What so are we expecting from Dharma? And I would request you, sir, to please shed some light on this. What is the problem in such statements, sir? Are we expecting something totally wrong from Dharma? I mean, is Dharma supposed to do all these things?
Dharma tells you rules of action. Pleasure is something that you want. No, the Dharma is not supposed to give you pleasure when you want. And these are choices. See, people don't realize. We have been given a mind that has got the ability to make choices. We are run by software, not hardware, as animals and lower beings are. And software is controlled by an operating system. If you install a good operating system, which is dharmic, then your actions will be alright, your desires will be under control. If you operate a corrupt operating system, it will promote desires. So you want desires, but you want fruits of the good operating system. It won't. That is a contradiction. I will go this way, but I want the fruits of that.
Yes.
This has got its own erratic way of functioning, that has got its own right way of functioning. You can't have the cake and eat it too. I thought that was well known. Now, basically, this is, you know, I want Dharma as I like it.
Yeah.
That's it, what
like
it boils down.
Conveniently placing Dharma as some tool.
No. You see, I want rules of action that suit me. That is, legislature can make laws like that. If, for example, if you have a lobbyist, he will go and get the legislature to pass a law that is convenient to you. You get rules. Dharma is rooted in the divine. Divine has made up his mind, what shall be done and what shall not be done. God, that's fine, but why don't you give me a concession here? So why don't you please do what I say?
And the other important thing is when he's talking about the ends of human life, the goals of human life, he's only talking about dharma, artha and kama. He's conveniently excluding moksha. For some reason he says moksha.
No, but one thing he says, at that point of time when Mahabharata took place,
yes,
moksha had not yet been added to the list.
Okay, so that is what... Now, once you take out moksha of that equation of dharma, artha and kama, then obviously, and if you look at dharma, then obviously there is a huge gap.
No, but there is one small point, even though he said he's going to have the last word. I was just listening to somebody saying that she is a German Jew who lived in Germany, survived Holocaust. There is a very long story of that.
Yes.
And then she continued to live in Berlin. She died recently, and then she never talked about her past, but finally her son put a microphone and revealed herself. And she makes one statement there. It was a great thing to be liberated from fear. For her, moksha was not being afraid. And then she said, it is only then I began to look for other things. So the pleasure and all comes later. I want to be freed from bondage, oppression.
Yes.
Oppression can come in various ways. Oppression can come from outside. Oppression can come from within. I have become obsessed with something like drugs.
Yes, sir.
Which I am not, luckily. But then and it's frightening me. I am afraid of my addiction. I have to be liberated. Then I am free. Free from what? Free from certain things that are not good for me. Then I can think of this being hooked on pleasure is that market phenomenon. Because you think those goodies are going to give me pleasure.
Yes.
Having another car will give me more pleasure. Neighbors envy, owners parade. This kind of situation. Okay, Bishop, I'll shut up.
No, definitely, I think we can go on discussing on this. In fact, when I look at this chapter and your talk, I think all of us still have at least a list of 7-8 questions for which we would love to discuss. But then that is how it is when you talk about dharma. And he has brought out so many more concepts which you also refer to, about means and ends and
no, he has stimulated our mind. There is no question about
yes.
it. He made a good contribution.
Yes, and definitely with Swami's grace we will continue this discussion and have many more sessions. Thank you so much, Aman, for coming from the university, and Professor Prusen. And we hope...
Thank you also.
Of course, I have to... I mean, I don't know how to thank, sir, because I mean, the whole thing needs to get...
Sunil is waiting.
Yes.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 13th question and answer session based on Professor G. Venkatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you like the session. And next week we'll be continuing the present series, so please don't forget to tune in then. And we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up next week. So watch out this space. We thank you for listening. And as always, the podcast of this program may be accessed via our website, www.radiosci.org. And dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosci.org. Coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment, Service, Love in Action with Raghu. Please stay tuned. Thank you, and Jai Sai Ram.